There's always significant interest in Australia in the housing market and the housing industry, and in recent years, housing-related factors have had a significant influence on the world economy. So this Congress will be covering issues of great interest to many of us. In my talk today, I'll discuss a number of issues concerning the Australian housing sector, including housing affordability, the supply and demand for housing, and the broader economic environment. I won't be commenting directly on the monetary policy situation. Let me start by noting that the Australian housing market, like the broader economy, has softened recently. But the housing sector is one that demonstrates quite well the differences between the Australian economy and some of the larger economies, such as the United States and the United Kingdom. Overall, housing prices in Australia softened over 2008 by around 3%. The recent weakness has been mainly at the higher end of the market, the green line in this chart. Property prices in more expensive suburbs had risen more over the prior few years, but have recently fallen noticeably. This presumably reflects the greater exposure of people in these suburbs to financial developments. However, the other suburbs, which constitute a much larger share of the total housing stock, the blue line, saw much smaller declines in 2008. We don't yet have much data for price developments in early 2009, but auction clearance rates for Sydney and Melbourne provide a preliminary gauge. And these picked up significantly recently relative to late 2008. The modest fall in Australian housing prices in 2008 was much smaller than the double-digit falls seen in the US and the UK. Similarly, the falls in housing approvals and in broader measures of economic activity in Australia have been smaller than the declines seen in many other countries. Furthermore, there are a number of reasons to think that outcomes here might remain better than elsewhere. These relate both to the role of policy in responding to the downturn and the consolidation of household finances that has occurred here since our housing boom slowed earlier in this decade around the end of 2003. I'll now turn to a specific aspect of the housing market, namely housing affordability. I'm going to focus on affordability for current or potential home buyers rather than on measures of affordability for renters. But the owner-occupier and the rental markets are clearly linked, and some of the issues I discuss today have implications for the cost of housing for renters too. There are many complications in measuring affordability, and there is no single ideal measure. However, the measure shown here is a reasonably standard one. It's an index of the ratio of average household disposable income to the principal and interest repayments on a new mortgage for the median-priced dwelling. The line in this graph goes up to the end of 2008, and the dot shows an estimate based on the current level of mortgage rates. It's clear that purchase affordability has recently improved significantly in Australia. The standard affordability measures reflect the interaction of two factors: the mortgage interest rate, the green line in this graph, and the ratio of housing prices to household incomes, the blue line. If interest rates fall, or if housing prices rise less rapidly than incomes, then affordability improves, and vice versa. The recent improvement in affordability mostly reflects the sharp fall in mortgage rates over the past half year. The fall in interest rates reflects the adjustment of Australian monetary policy to the deterioration in the outlook for the global and domestic economies. As you know, there's been a dramatic weakening in the world economy over the past half year. Average GDP growth in our major trading partners was sharply negative in the December quarter of 2008. And the March quarter of 2009 is unlikely to have been much better. As a result, monetary and fiscal policies have both been eased significantly in Australia over the past 6 months. While there are concerns in some other economies about whether the easings in monetary policy have been especially effective, there can be no such doubt here. In Australia, the cash rate has now been cut by 400 basis points since September 2008. This is the rightmost bar in the top panel of this graph. Standard variable housing rates have fallen by 375 basis points. That's the final grey bar in the middle panel. And when we take an average of the interest rates paid on all housing loans, including fixed rate ones, the fall is around 265 basis points. This is the final bar in the bottom panel. In contrast, central banks in other countries have also cut their policy rates significantly, but have typically seen much smaller reductions in the actual rates paid by households. The difference partly reflects the fact that a greater proportion of Australian borrowing is at variable interest rates. Furthermore, Australian banks are in healthier shape than those in most other economies, so they have been more able to pass through reductions in their funding costs. The bank's financial stability review, released today, provides further details on the health of the banking sector and the broader financial system. So it is clear that monetary policy has been effective in lowering borrowing costs in the Australian economy. In aggregate terms, the fall in borrowing rates has reduced the debt servicing burden of the household sector by approximately 5% of household disposable income. That implies a significant amount of cash flow relief for spending on other goods and services, or to save or pay down debt. In addition to the effect on the cash flows of those who currently have mortgages, the reduction in interest rates improves the accessibility of home ownership for potential home buyers. Of course, mortgage rates will fluctuate over time. At some point in the future, interest rates will presumably be at more normal levels. Here, I'm not making any comment about the current policy juncture, just making a statement about the cyclical nature of economies. So one question that we should ask is whether a period of quite low mortgage rates in Australia could lead to the type of problems that are being seen in the United States. In the middle of this decade, the US had an expansion of lending to higher risk households, which took out mortgages at low initial interest rates that were scheduled to reset a few years later at much higher interest rates. Much of this lending was premised on the expectation that housing prices would continue to rise. So the increase in equity would allow the borrower to refinance to a more conventional mortgage before the mortgage reset to the much higher rate. Of course, this type of lending was also facilitated by securitisation into the capital markets, where investors were not especially discriminating in what they would buy. So the question arises whether a period of low interest rates in Australia, combined with the boost in grants to first home buyers, could lead to an expansion of lending to riskier borrowers who will only be able to afford their mortgages as long as interest rates remain low. I think there are good reasons to think this is not a major risk. Australian lending standards were never relaxed during the boom as much as they were in the United States. We can see this in the proportion of non-performing loans on bank balance sheets in the two countries. The US ratio, the pink line, is far higher than in Australia now, but it was also significantly higher a few years ago when both economies were experiencing strong economic growth. But in any case, many of the lenders that might now have been most likely to write riskier loans have scaled back their activity. The past year and a half has seen lending standards tighten in Australia, with a significant shrinkage in the amount of low doc and non-conforming lending. Most lending is now staying on balance sheet, and a greater share is being done by banks, which have tended to reduce their maximum loan-to-value ratios. Our discussion with banks indicate that they are indeed testing the ability of borrowers to continue servicing their loans if interest rates were to rise significantly. No doubt, as at any time, some of the loans being written now will turn sour. However, overall, I suspect that the risk of non-performing loans increasing to the extent seen in the United States is low. Nevertheless, households that are considering entering into home ownership need to carefully consider their own circumstances, including whether or not they would be able to continue servicing their loans if mortgage rates were at some point to begin to return to more normal levels. In addition to mortgage rates, the second determinant of standard affordability measures is the ratio of housing prices to income, the blue line in this chart. At present, this ratio remains slightly above its average over the low inflation period since 1993. Of course, there may be good reasons for it to have experienced a trend increase over recent decades as the economy adjusted to a structural shift to lower inflation. But the housing price to income ratio has declined significantly since its peak in late 2003. Over the period since then, nationwide house prices have grown on average by 4% per annum versus annual growth of 14% in the prior five-year period. And the growth rate of house prices in the past 5 years has been well below the 8% average annual growth in household disposable incomes. So the price-to-income ratio, a frequently used but crude measure of housing price valuation, suggests that any overvaluation of housing prices has eased significantly since the Australian housing boom slowed in late 2003. Since then, households have had significant income growth, but that growth has flowed only to a modest extent into housing prices. Some other perspectives would also indicate positive trends in household behaviour over the past 5 years. In the period leading up to 2003, growth in household consumption spending, the brown line in this chart, ran ahead of growth in household income, the blue line. As a result, the saving ratio, which is the pink line in the bottom panel, declined significantly. But since 2003, this trend has been reversed. Households have seen strong income growth, but their growth in consumption has been lower. On average, annual growth in spending has run about 2.5 percentage points below income growth in this period. As a result, the saving ratio has risen significantly, and in trend terms, is back at levels seen in the mid-1990s, before the start of the housing boom. Data for so-called housing equity injection provide another perspective on household behaviour. In aggregate, housing equity injection is a measure of the extent to which we have increased our net ownership of housing, abstracting from valuation effects. As we construct new housing, the blue line in the top panel, the dwelling stock grows. But if we increase our borrowing for housing, the red line, this reduces the amount by which we are building up equity in housing. Historically, the community increased its net equity in the housing stock each year, the pink bars in the bottom panel. But from the mid-1990s, this began to change as the growth of housing-secured borrowing rose. This coincided with greater competition in the market for housing finance. It was also the period when the share of investors in new lending grew significantly. Indeed, early in this decade, growth in housing credit exceeded the value of new housing being built. However, a reversal of this trend started around the end of 2003. Growth in housing credit gradually slowed over the past 5 years. Housing equity withdrawal gradually declined, and we've now returned to the more normal state of affairs, where we are again increasing our equity in the housing stock. And as the boom in the housing market cooled, the share of investors in lending approvals has fallen from over 40% in 2003 to 30% now, to below 30% now. So these trends in the housing price-to-income ratio, the household saving rate, and housing equity injection illustrate some beneficial developments in household finances over the past 5 years. If the housing boom that was underway earlier this decade had continued, along with some of the behaviour that accompanied it, no doubt we would now be facing greater risks. But the housing boom here came to an end earlier than in many other countries. And household behaviour has changed significantly since then. As a result, our economy and household and financial sectors have entered this global slowdown in far better shape than otherwise. Of course, as I noted earlier, mortgage rates will fluctuate over time. So in the long run, housing affordability will be mostly driven by the level of housing prices relative to household incomes. This brings me to the issue of supply and demand in the housing market. I've previously suggested, as have many others, that the relatively high level of housing prices in Australia is to a large extent a reflection of demand and the collective decisions of households. That is, housing prices have not been set at high levels by some external force. They are at their current levels because buyers in aggregate, with their incomes, preferences, access to finance, and other influences, have been willing to pay those prices. But it is also the case that supply-side factors matter. Here I define these broadly to include factors affecting the ability to build new housing on the city fringe, factors affecting the expansion of supply closer to city centres, and factors such as community and transport infrastructure that influence the feasibility and desirability of living in different places. The last two of these factors are hard to quantify, but one element influencing the first is the cost of land. We recently looked at the cost of low-priced land in new developments near the edges of our five largest cities. It's probably a good indicator of some of the supply issues there. Land prices are clearly highest on the edges of Sydney and lowest on the edges of Melbourne and Adelaide. Overall, prices still appear quite high, given that this is supposed to be about the lowest cost land available in those cities. It'll be interesting to see whether it is possible to reduce these prices or at least keep a lid on increases in coming years. The ability to expand the supply of housing will be one of the factors that influences housing affordability over the medium term. And the performance of the home building sector will be an important influence on economic activity over the current period, over the coming period, when international factors will be restraining growth in Australia. As you'll know, home building has recently been at relatively low levels, with commencements of around 147,000 dwellings in 2008. And towards the end of the year, commencements and building approvals were running at lower levels than that. The recent weakness in approvals will be reflected in further falls in construction activity over the first half of this year. But looking beyond that, there are several factors which should contribute to growth. Most importantly, the falls in interest rates and improvements in housing affordability that have occurred over the past 6 months have not really fed through into housing construction activity yet, but can be expected to gradually boost home building over time. First home buyer demand is also expanding following the boost to grants for these buyers. We can see this from the increase in the number of grant payments made in recent months, the blue line, and the rise in the share of first home buyers in loan approvals, the brown line. Much of this demand will be for existing dwellings, but we can also expect that it will gradually feed through into the data for building approvals and building activity. In fact, we're seeing some evidence of this already in our liaison with home builders. Another factor that should support home building over the medium term is that we're starting from a position of some undersupply in the housing market. Although there is some uncertainty as to how large the undersupply is, I suspect it may be smaller than some of the estimates you may have seen. The largest estimates of the cumulative undersupply are based on comparisons of actual completions in recent years with estimates of so-called underlying demand. This figuring is essentially asking the following question. Given current population growth rates, if the decline in average household size and the level of demand for second homes that have occurred over recent decades had been maintained in recent years, how many new homes would we need to build? Most calculations now put underlying demand at something like 180 to 200,000 dwellings per year, which means we would have needed to build significantly more homes than has actually occurred. However, such figuring is based on simply extrapolating earlier trends and ignores the likely impact of prices on the demand for housing. Over recent decades, the cost of housing, including land, has grown faster than incomes and the cost of many other goods and services. This reflects both demand and supply factors. But we might expect that at some point, the demand for housing will be affected by the higher cost of housing. For example, with housing, both owner-occupied and rental, more expensive than in the past, we might expect some young adults to choose to live with their parents for longer. We might expect some households to look for an extra flatmate rather than leaving a bedroom vacant. Some owners of holiday homes or second homes might become more inclined to sell them with those houses then occupied full time. So perhaps the longer term run-up in the cost of housing is one of the reasons that we've built fewer homes in recent years than might have been expected. Now, I'm not saying that there is no undersupply of housing. At the very least, one can look at estimates that the nationwide rental vacancy rate is currently around 1.5% versus more normal levels of around 3%. Given a rental stock of around 2.5 million dwellings, a simple calculation would imply the need for about 40,000 additional dwellings to get the rental market back closer to balance. And one can also make further adjustment for the homeless. But whatever the true shortfall of dwellings, we can say with some confidence that our housing market is relatively tight. This can be contrasted with the US market, which many observers characterise as subject to overbuilding during their housing boom. And the relative tightness of the Australian housing market is one factor that will support home building in the period ahead. A final influence supporting construction will be the measures that the federal government has taken to boost housing supply. Examples are the National Rental Affordability Scheme, which aims to stimulate the supply of up to 50,000 new units of affordable rental housing, and the Housing Affordability Fund, which will finance projects to reduce the cost of bringing new supply to market. State government measures may also help, such as the New South Wales government's reduction of infrastructure charges. Policies such as these will help to support home building at a time when activity in the broader economy will be subdued. They also offer the prospect of lowering the cost of housing in the medium term. Indeed, perhaps the best chance of boosting housing construction on a sustainable basis may be the reduction of impediments on the supply side that arise either excessively boosting the cost of building new housing on the fringes of our cities, or are excessively constraining building of more housing closer to city centres. Regardless of the cyclical factors that are currently influencing the housing market, it is important to keep thinking about medium and longer term reforms to the housing market that can improve the functioning of the market and potentially lower the cost of housing over the longer run, especially for lower income groups. No doubt some of the other speakers in this Congress will speak more about these important structural issues. So there are three main points that I would like to emphasise today. First, the recent significant falls in the cash rate are having positive effects on the economy and the household sector, and have contributed to a significant improvement in household cash flows. Second, although home building is likely to remain weak in the near term, there are a number of factors which should support activity over the medium term and provide stimulus to the broader economy. Finally, when one looks at the behaviour of the household sector over the past 5 years, in particular the trends in housing prices and household income, spending and borrowing, there has been a significant degree of consolidation since the housing boom slowed in late 2003. This will reduce the vulnerability of the household sector in the current slowdown. Thank you. There's always significant interest in Australia in the housing market and the housing industry, and in recent years, housing-related factors have had a significant influence on the world economy. So this Congress will be covering issues of great interest to many of us. In my talk today, I'll discuss a number of issues concerning the Australian housing sector, including housing affordability, the supply and demand for housing, and the broader economic environment. I won't be commenting directly on the monetary policy situation. Let me start by noting that the Australian housing market, like the broader economy, has softened recently. But the housing sector is one that demonstrates quite well the differences between the Australian economy and some of the larger economies, such as the United States and the United Kingdom. Overall, housing prices in Australia softened over 2008 by around 3%. The recent weakness has been mainly at the higher end of the market, the green line in this chart. Property prices in more expensive suburbs had risen more over the prior few years, but have recently fallen noticeably. This presumably reflects the greater exposure of people in these suburbs to financial developments. However, the other suburbs, which constitute a much larger share of the total housing stock, the blue line, saw much smaller declines in 2008. We don't yet have much data for price developments in early 2009, but auction clearance rates for Sydney and Melbourne provide a preliminary gauge. And these picked up significantly relative to late 2008. The modest fall in Australian housing prices in 2008 was much smaller than the double-digit falls seen in the US and the UK. Similarly, the falls in housing approvals and in broader measures of economic activity in Australia have been smaller than the declines seen in many other countries. Furthermore, there are a number of reasons to think that outcomes here might remain better than elsewhere. These relate both to the role of policy in responding to the downturn and the consolidation of household finances that has occurred here since our housing boom slowed earlier in this decade around the end of 2003. I'll now turn to a specific aspect of the housing market, namely housing affordability. I'm going to focus on affordability for current or potential home buyers rather than on measures of affordability for renters. But the owner-occupier and the rental markets are clearly linked, and some of the issues I discussed today have implications for the cost of housing for renters too. There are many complications in measuring affordability, and there is no single ideal measure. However, the measure shown here is a reasonably standard one. It's an index of the ratio of average household disposable income to the principal and interest repayments on a new mortgage for the median-priced dwelling. The line in this graph goes up to the end of 2008, and the dot shows an estimate based on the current level of mortgage rates. It's clear that purchase affordability has recently improved significantly in Australia. The standard affordability measures reflect the interaction of two factors: the mortgage interest rate, the green line in this graph, and the ratio of housing prices to household incomes, the blue line. If interest rates fall, or if housing prices rise less rapidly than incomes, then affordability improves, and vice versa. The recent improvement in affordability mostly reflects the sharp fall in mortgage rates over the past half year. The fall in interest rates reflects the adjustment of Australian monetary policy to the deterioration in the outlook for the global and domestic economies. As you know, there's been a dramatic weakening in the world economy over the past half year. Average GDP growth in our major trading partners was sharply negative in the December quarter of 2008, and the March quarter of 2009 is unlikely to have been much better. As a result, monetary and fiscal policies have both been eased significantly in Australia over the past 6 months. While there are concerns in some other economies about whether the easings in monetary policy have been especially effective, there can be no such doubt here. In Australia, the cash rate has now been cut by 400 basis points since September 2008. This is the rightmost bar in the top panel of this graph. Standard variable housing rates have fallen by 375 basis points. That's the final grey bar in the middle panel. And when we take an average of the interest rates paid on all housing loans, including fixed rate ones, the fall is around 265 basis points. This is the final bar in the bottom panel. In contrast, central banks in other countries have also cut their policy rates significantly, but have typically seen much smaller reductions in the actual rates paid by households. The difference partly reflects the fact that a greater proportion of Australian borrowing is at variable interest rates. Furthermore, Australian banks are in healthier shape than those in most other economies, so they have been more able to pass through reductions in their funding costs. The bank's financial stability review, released today, provides further details on the health of the banking sector and the broader financial system. So it is clear that monetary policy has been effective in lowering borrowing costs in the Australian economy. In aggregate terms, the fall in borrowing rates has reduced the debt servicing burden of the household sector by approximately 5% of household disposable income. That implies a significant amount of cash flow relief for spending on other goods and services, or to save or pay down debt. In addition to the effect on the cash flows of those who currently have mortgages, the reduction in interest rates improves the accessibility of home ownership for potential home buyers. Of course, mortgage rates will fluctuate over time. At some point in the future, interest rates will presumably be at more normal levels. Here, I'm not making any comment about the current policy juncture, just making a statement about the cyclical nature of economies. So one question that we should ask is whether a period of quite low mortgage rates in Australia could lead to the type of problems that are being seen in the United States. In the middle of this decade, the US had an expansion of lending to higher risk households, which took out mortgages at low initial interest rates that were scheduled to reset a few years later at much higher interest rates. Much of this lending was premised on the expectation that housing prices would continue to rise. So the increase in equity would allow the borrower to refinance to a more conventional mortgage before the mortgage reset to the much higher rate. Of course, this type of lending was also facilitated by securitisation into the capital markets, where investors were not especially discriminating in what they would buy. So the question arises whether a period of low interest rates in Australia, combined with the boost in grants to first home buyers, could lead to an expansion of lending to riskier borrowers who will only be able to afford their mortgages as long as interest rates remain low. I think there are good reasons to think this is not a major risk. Australian lending standards were never relaxed during the boom as much as they were in the United States. We can see this in the proportion of non-performing loans on bank balance sheets in the two countries. The US ratio, the pink line, is far higher than in Australia now, but it was also significantly higher a few years ago when both economies were experiencing strong economic growth. But in any case, many of the lenders that might now have been most likely to write riskier loans have scaled back their activity. The past year and a half has seen lending standards tighten in Australia, with a significant shrinkage in the amount of low doc and non-conforming lending. Most lending is now staying on balance sheet, and a greater share is being done by banks, which have tended to reduce their maximum loan-to-value ratios. Our discussion with banks indicate that they are indeed testing the ability of borrowers to continue servicing their loans if interest rates were to rise significantly. No doubt, as at any time, some of the loans being written now will turn sour. However, overall, I suspect that the risk of non-performing loans increasing to the extent seen in the United States is low. Nevertheless, households that are considering entering into home ownership need to carefully consider their own circumstances, including whether or not they would be able to continue servicing their loans if mortgage rates were at some point to begin to return to more normal levels. In addition to mortgage rates, the second determinant of standard affordability measures is the ratio of housing prices to income, the blue line in this chart. At present, this ratio remains slightly above its average over the low inflation period since 1993. Of course, there may be good reasons for it to have experienced a trend increase over recent decades as the economy adjusted to a structural shift to lower inflation. But the housing price to income ratio has declined significantly since its peak in late 2003. Over the period since then, nationwide house prices have grown on average by 4% per annum versus annual growth of 14% in the prior five-year period. And the growth rate of house prices in the past 5 years has been well below the 8% average annual growth in household disposable incomes. So the price-to-income ratio, a frequently used but crude measure of housing price valuation, suggests that any overvaluation of housing prices has eased significantly since the Australian housing boom slowed in late 2003. Since then, households have had significant income growth, but that growth has flowed only to a modest extent into housing prices. Some other perspectives would also indicate positive trends in household behaviour over the past 5 years. In the period leading up to 2003, growth in household consumption spending, the brown line in this chart, ran ahead of growth in household income, the blue line. As a result, the saving ratio, which is the pink line in the bottom panel, declined significantly. But since 2003, this trend has been reversed. Households have seen strong income growth, but their growth in consumption has been lower. On average, annual growth in spending has run about 2.5 percentage points below income growth in this period. As a result, the saving ratio has risen significantly, and in trend terms, is back at levels seen in the mid-1990s, before the start of the housing boom. Data for so-called housing equity injection provide another perspective on household behaviour. In aggregate, housing equity injection is a measure of the extent to which we have increased our net ownership of housing, abstracting from valuation effects. As we construct new housing, the blue line in the top panel, the dwelling stock grows. But if we increase our borrowing for housing, the red line, this reduces the amount by which we are building up equity in housing. Historically, the community increased its net equity in the housing stock each year, the pink bars in the bottom panel. But from the mid-1990s, this began to change as the growth of housing-secured borrowing rose. This coincided with greater competition in the market for housing finance. It was also the period when the share of investors in new lending grew significantly. Indeed, early in this decade, growth in housing credit exceeded the value of new housing being built. However, a reversal of this trend started around the end of 2003. Growth in housing credit gradually slowed over the past 5 years. Housing equity withdrawal gradually declined, and we've now returned to the more normal state of affairs, where we are again increasing our equity in the housing stock. And as the boom in the housing market cooled, the share of investors in lending approvals has fallen from over 40% in 2003 to 30% now, to below 30% now. So these trends in the housing price-to-income ratio, the household saving rate, and housing equity injection illustrate some beneficial developments in household finances over the past 5 years. If the housing boom that was underway earlier this decade had continued, along with some of the behaviour that accompanied it, no doubt we would now be facing greater risks. But the housing boom here came to an end earlier than in many other countries, and household behaviour has changed significantly since then. As a result, our economy and household and financial sectors have entered this global slowdown in far better shape than otherwise. Of course, as I noted earlier, mortgage rates will fluctuate over time. So in the long run, housing affordability will be mostly driven by the level of housing prices relative to household incomes. This brings me to the issue of supply and demand in the housing market. I've previously suggested, as have many others, that the relatively high level of housing prices in Australia is to a large extent a reflection of demand and the collective decisions of households. That is, housing prices have not been set at high levels by some external force. They are at their current levels because buyers in aggregate, with their incomes, preferences, access to finance, and other influences, have been willing to pay those prices. But it is also the case that supply-side factors matter. Here I define these broadly to include factors affecting the ability to build new housing on the city fringe, factors affecting the expansion of supply closer to city centres, and factors such as community and transport infrastructure that influence the feasibility and desirability of living in different places. The last two of these factors are hard to quantify, but one element influencing the first is the cost of land. We recently looked at the cost of low-priced land in new developments near the edges of our five largest cities. It's probably a good indicator of some of the supply issues there. Land prices are clearly highest on the edges of Sydney and lowest on the edges of Melbourne and Adelaide. Overall, prices still appear quite high, given that this is supposed to be about the lowest cost land available in those cities. It'll be interesting to see whether it is possible to reduce these prices or at least keep a lid on increases in coming years. The ability to expand the supply of housing will be one of the factors that influences housing affordability over the medium term. And the performance of the home building sector will be an important influence on economic activity over the current period, over the coming period, when international factors will be restraining growth in Australia. As you'll know, home building has recently been at relatively low levels, with commencements of around 147,000 dwellings in 2008. And towards the end of the year, commencements and building approvals were running at lower levels than that. The recent weakness in approvals will be reflected in further falls in construction activity over the first half of this year. But looking beyond that, there are several factors which should contribute to growth. Most importantly, the falls in interest rates and improvements in housing affordability that have occurred over the past 6 months have not really fed through into housing construction activity yet, but can be expected to gradually boost home building over time. First home buyer demand is also expanding, following the boost to grants for these buyers. We can see this from the increase in the number of grant payments made in recent months, the blue line, and the rise in the share of first home buyers in loan approvals, the brown line. Much of this demand will be for existing dwellings, but we can also expect that it will gradually feed through into the data for building approvals and building activity. In fact, we're seeing some evidence of this already in our liaison with home builders. Another factor that should support home building over the medium term is that we're starting from a position of some undersupply in the housing market. Although there is some uncertainty as to how large the undersupply is, I suspect it may be smaller than some of the estimates you may have seen. The largest estimates of the cumulative undersupply are based on comparisons of actual completions in recent years with estimates of so-called underlying demand. This figuring is essentially asking the following question. Given current population growth rates, if the decline in average household size and the level of demand for second homes that have occurred over recent decades had been maintained in recent years, how many new homes would we need to build? Most calculations now put underlying demand at something like 180,000 to 200,000 dwellings per year, which means we would have needed to build significantly more homes than has actually occurred. However, such figuring is based on simply extrapolating earlier trends and ignores the likely impact of prices on the demand for housing. Over recent decades, the cost of housing, including land, has grown faster than incomes and the cost of many other goods and services. This reflects both demand and supply factors. But we might expect that at some point, the demand for housing will be affected by the higher cost of housing. For example, with housing, both owner-occupied and rental, more expensive than in the past, we might expect some young adults to choose to live with their parents for longer. We might expect some households to look for an extra flatmate rather than leaving a bedroom vacant. Some owners of holiday homes or second homes might become more inclined to sell them with those houses then occupied full-time. So perhaps the longer-term run-up in the cost of housing is one of the reasons that we've built fewer homes in recent years than might have been expected. Now, I'm not saying that there is no undersupply of housing. At the very least, one can look at estimates that the nationwide rental vacancy rate is currently around 1.5% versus more normal levels of around 3%. Given a rental stock of around 2.5 million dwellings, a simple calculation would imply the need for about 40,000 additional dwellings to get the rental market back closer to balance. And one can also make further adjustment for the homeless. But whatever the true shortfall of dwellings, we can say with some confidence that our housing market is relatively tight. This can be contrasted with the US market, which many observers characterise as subject to overbuilding during their housing boom. And the relative tightness of the Australian housing market is one factor that will support home building in the period ahead. A final influence supporting construction will be the measures that the federal government has taken to boost housing supply. Examples are the National Rental Affordability Scheme, which aims to stimulate the supply of up to 50,000 new units of affordable rental housing, and the Housing Affordability Fund, which will finance projects to reduce the cost of bringing new supply to market. State government measures may also help, such as the New South Wales government's reduction of infrastructure charges. Policies such as these will help to support home building at a time when activity in the broader economy will be subdued. They also offer the prospect of lowering the cost of housing in the medium term. Indeed, perhaps the best chance of boosting housing construction on a sustainable basis may be the reduction of impediments on the supply side that arise either excessively boosting the cost of building new housing on the fringes of our cities or are excessively constraining building of more housing closer to city centres. Regardless of the cyclical factors that are currently influencing the housing market, it is important to keep thinking about medium and longer term reforms to the housing market that can improve the functioning of the market and potentially lower the cost of housing over the longer run, especially for lower income groups. No doubt some of the other speakers in this Congress will speak more about these important structural issues. So there are three main points that I would like to emphasise today. First, the recent significant falls in the cash rate are having positive effects on the economy and the household sector, and have contributed to a significant improvement in household cash flows. Second, although home building is likely to remain weak in the near term, there are a number of factors which should support activity over the medium term and provide stimulus to the broader economy. Finally, when one looks at the behaviour of the household sector over the past 5 years, in particular the trends in housing prices and household income, spending and borrowing, there has been a significant degree of consolidation since the housing boom slowed in late 2003. This will reduce the vulnerability of the household sector in the current slowdown. Thank you.
Gail Sadler from Blue Chip. Given the rise in unemployment that we are obviously going to see flowing through 2009 and 2010, how do you see this impacting on housing affordability and people's ability to purchase or, you know, default on mortgages?
With the slowing in the global economy, we can expect the unemployment rate to increase in Australia. This will lead to some increased vulnerability in the housing sector. But as I noted, policy has responded. We've had significant easings in fiscal and monetary policy. Significant cash flow relief to homeowners. Anyone paying off a mortgage has had a significant cash flow relief with the reduction in mortgage rates. So this will cushion the effect on households of the worsening in the global economy over the next few years.
Carolyn Curry, Public-Private Sector Partnership. And yes, I am responsible for that plan because it was a suggestion over dinner at the Fed Reserve last September. So I apologise if you don't like it. My question to you is willingness of the banks to lend in this type of climate to residential mortgages. And the other aspect is for some intervention or suggestions to be made, a la Obama, of how to carry borrowers through periods of unemployment, similar to what the National Australia Bank did with the farming community, where they actually asked their borrowers to put aside extra money during periods of employment, which they could then access during periods of unemployment. Other suggestions are some type of insurance scheme that one can take, similar to credit cards, some sort of disability insurance. I know that Centrelink is meant to be unemployment insurance, but it takes a long time to get that money moving. So I think we've got to come up with some schemes of forbearance that are advocated to banks at the highest authority regarding people who are defaulting. Thank you.
I think there's some interesting ideas there that how banks should respond in these circumstances. That's something I think I'd leave to the banking sector to deal with. Your question about the willingness of banks to lend, our discussions with banks indicate that they are still very much open for business for housing lending. There has been some tightening of lending standards, some reduction in loan-to-value ratios, some reduction in the willingness to lend to higher-risk borrowers. These are probably positive trends, but overall our assessment is that there is still a good flow of finance going to the household sector from the banks.
Julian Disney from the University of New South Wales. Tony, you referred to the level of demand as being a key factor in all this and spoke of the choice that households have exercised in the absence of an external force. It seems to me there are at least five major external forces which have hugely distorted their choice. Our chair would probably be saying this if she wasn't being decorous, but firstly, the exemption of owner-occupied property from the capital gains tax. Secondly, the uncapped exemption. Secondly, the uncapped exemption from land tax. Thirdly, the uncapped exemption from the pensions assets test. Fourthly, the most generous system of negative gearing in the world. Fifthly, the first homeowner grant. Is it really correct to describe this as a sort of unalloyed free choice?
In my talk, I said that there's a whole range of factors influencing households, and obviously not just the incomes, but the institutional arrangements surrounding home ownership are obviously important, and you've highlighted the impact of tax factors. I think it is the case that the ownership of housing in Australia is favoured relative, for example, to other goods and services. So it wouldn't be surprising if housing is favoured, is tax favoured, if people chose to spend more on housing than they do than other goods and services relative to other countries, and that this would force up the price of the cost of housing relative to some other countries. So tax factors are important, but they're one of many factors influencing on housing prices.
Okay, I have just a follow-up question on that one, because you talk about the build-up again in housing equity after having sort of gone down a little bit before. But seemingly carrying on from the side of question that Julian was asking, that we talk about housing demand being driven essentially by population growth, household growth, which you were talking about how that might react to house prices and income growth. But we're also accumulating a huge amount of housing wealth, which presumably, I know there's people saying that adults my age are going to ski, spend their kids' inheritance, but there's not a lot of evidence they are doing so. So that as my generation, those drop off the perch, there's going to be a huge amount of inheritance going down to those who are lucky enough to have parents who are in home ownership. What sort of effect do you think that'll have on housing demand?
The question of the extent to which housing wealth really represents wealth, I think, is an interesting one. And the run-up in house prices has been as you highlight, something that's good for those that already have home ownership or own rental properties, and the run-up in house prices has been less good for those that that don't own housing, that are renters. Income transfers from generation to generation are one way that next generation will be able to afford housing. That'll obviously be less the case for lower income groups that aren't fortunate enough to benefit from income transfers from their parents.